It's Live Music Friday here on Current State on WKAR. And the DeCamp Sisters are our special performing guests today from Romeo, Michigan. They have two EPs that they've recorded. They're embarking on a tour, and we will hear more from Riley and Libby DeCamp throughout the hour and talk about their music with them in a bit. Another reminder, next Tuesday is also Earth Day. Earth Day is almost here. Contribute any amount to WKAR that you can, and we'll plant a tree in mid-Michigan. And your contribution will go to Current State and Classical Music and Morning Edition. It's money well spent in a couple of different ways, right? We've got a special Earth Day celebration planned for Tuesday. Plan to give then, just between you and me, you can go to the website right now and donate now. Just go to WKAR.org and click on the Give Now link. And many thanks to those of you who have done that. And if you haven't done it yet, please plan to join us on Tuesday. At the top of our program today, a host of challenges associated with Michigan's prison system make corrections one of the state's biggest and most persistent issues. Michigan has around 43,000 prisoners in its state system. They reside in 31 state prisons and affiliated health care facilities. No discussion of Michigan corrections lasts long without the topic of its dollar cost coming up. Supervision and care of those inmates cost the state about $2 billion a year in total. As a percentage of its general fund budget, no state spends more than Michigan. It's an expenditure that many feel is unsustainable despite a recent drop in the number of prisoners. Reporter Ted Roloffs writes at length about these challenges in the latest edition of Bridge Magazine. He joins us now. Welcome to Current State, Ted.
Good to be with you.
You write that the political left and the political right have in the past focused on different features of the correctional system, the left on the disproportionate number of people of color who are imprisoned, and the right on the very significant dollar costs associated with the state prison system. But you suggest that both sides may be coming closer together on the need for reforms. What's bringing them closer together?
Well, I think if there's one single underlying reason for that, it would be the cost, which has come on over a period, actually, of decades. There's a realization, I think, especially, and maybe surprisingly to some, by some people on the political right, that if you want to look at it as sort of a business question, what's the bottom line? What are we getting for what we're spending? Does this make sense? Are there other ways to do this? Still keep our society safe and yet be more sensible with how we're spending our money. So to me, that's been the new element in the discussion of reform, is that you've got impetus now coming from the right to do this differently. And other states have already undertaken some pretty significant steps to reduce incarceration and reduce prison costs, to go to strategies other than building prisons to dealing with issues of crime. So I think that's kind of the new paradigm, if you will. It's come to fruition elsewhere. It has not reached that point in Michigan, and we'll see what happens down the road.
A little more context here. You point out that Michigan's prisoner population actually peaked back in 2006 and is now down about 8,000 inmates since then. You also refer to a Pew Center study from last year that found that Michigan's rate of incarceration fell 12% between 2007 and 2012. Why haven't those trends had a greater impact on cost? Is that clear?
Well, the cost would be greater, certainly, if the population had remained where it was in, I think it was 06, the peak of about 51,000.
Yes.
It's come down, but if you think about it logically, you've got costs, the whole cost of operating a prison, maintaining a prison, caring for the health care of prisoners, that's not going to go down. You've reduced the population, but those other costs are still wanting to push up, and a good part of what's driving that is the prison population is getting older. Older prisoners cost more to incarcerate. The health care costs, I think the numbers, if I'm looking at them here, prisoners age 35 to 39, it costs about $5,000 a year on average for health care. Prisoners 65, 69, you're up to $16,000. Those over 80, $40,000. And the Department of Corrections had assembled a list of the most expensive prisoners for health and or mental health care in the prison system. And I think they averaged about $220,000, the most expensive being over $300,000 for health care. So,
holy cow.
Yeah, that's part of it. And that's sort of part of what's driving this discussion of, does it make sense to keep prisoners? And these might be those who have even decades ago been involved in a violent crime. Are we going to incarcerate them till they die if they're eligible for parole? And that, you know, that's to me sort of a combination philosophic, moral, and ultimately budgetary question. So,
but this is an idea that is being more discussed among state leaders.
You know, there's been one person, and especially in the state house, Representative Joe Haveman out of Holland, who's been talking about this for several years now. Really, again, this is sort of emblematic of sort of the new way of thinking, and some people coming from the conservative realm of politics. And he's been trying to push this discussion forward for several years. He's working on legislation he hopes to introduce this year that would allow the release of elderly prisoners, to get them out of the prison system and into what would be basically nursing home care that would be out of the sphere of the Department of Corrections. So,
where Medicaid would theoretically cover expenses?
That's the hope. And the state of Connecticut has started a program like this. I think it was begun in 2013. It's still on a relatively small scale, and it's pretty narrowly defined. It's supposed to be for prisoners who are believed to be terminally ill or severely incapacitated, that sort of thing. But that's the, you know, the beginning of a new way of thinking about what do we do with some of our elderly prisoners who are in perhaps for serious crimes, but on the other hand, don't really pose any sort of threat to society. So,
we're talking with Bridge Magazine's Ted Roelofs about the challenges facing the Michigan correction system, in particular its exorbitant costs and whether or not there's a better way to go about this. I know Attorney General Bill Schuette has come out strongly against early release of young convicts serving mandatory life sentences, but do we know where the Attorney General stands on the early release of these older, more infirm prisoners?
He has given, as far as I'm aware, no indication that that's the road he wants to walk down. I did put out some questions to his office in assembling this piece, and basically what I got back was representative of statements he's made in the past. He wants to remind people that there, in this whole discussion of reform, we must not forget the victims and their families, and so that, I think, is kind of driving his thinking on that, that, well, there's a risk to doing this, and let's not forget that this person committed this crime. This, if a person's released at his earliest release date, goes out, commits another crime, who are we accountable to for that action? So, and I think that's long been a dynamic in thinking about prison reform, because you get a single high-profile case of a prisoner released, let's say at the earliest release date, had committed an earlier crime, goes out, and within a year or two or maybe 3 weeks commits another crime. That always gets a lot of media coverage, and that can sort of stop any debate right in its tracks about and that's one of the real difficulties of talking about serious reform, that, you know, there's always this, the other side of it, and the sort of the what-if side of it, and, you know, that's the delicate question of incarceration. But, you know, to take another step back from this, it might be worth asking, why is it that the United States incarcerates a bigger share of its population than any other country in the world? And why are we doing it this way, and why are the other countries doing it other ways? So, again, just to put it out there.
The state witnessed a number of reforms and other developments in the 80s and 90s that altogether toughened sentencing in Michigan and sentencing guidelines. Several suggestions on the table today would undo some of those moves. Let's talk about a few of those. Presumptive parole. What is presumptive parole?
Well, the idea there is, as it stands right now, with mandatory minimum sentencing, you're eligible for parole at your minimum release date. That has to be approved by the parole board. You need to present reasons for this. This is why this person should be released. Now, what often happens is it's denied, the person stays in prison, and that's why Michigan's length of incarceration is longer than most other states. It's a good reason why that's the case. Presumptive parole says you will be released at your earliest release date unless there's a compelling reason not to. So what you're going to end up with is prisoners are going to be, they're going to get out at that date. It also reinstates the good behavior reduction of prison time, which was eliminated with truth in sentencing.
Yeah, let's talk about truth in sentencing. That was one of the really memorable moves in the late 90s. And basically that was about ordering prisoners to serve at least their minimum sentence. You would say the pendulum is starting to swing in the opposite direction away from truth in sentencing reforms?
Well, there's discussion to let's take a look at this, and it hasn't, at this point, it's still at the discussion phase. There's talk about reinstating a sentencing commission to take a look at how Michigan sentences are guided. But that's something that would probably take a year or two to be to be put in place and to take effect. So at this point, there's more momentum to talk about this, but as you know from if you look at politics at all, big changes typically don't come overnight, and there's a lot of really tricky political issues to navigate for this to take place. So,
does the issue of rehabilitation come up in this discussion, Ted? Does anyone, for example, maintain that the prisons could rehabilitate more prisoners more quickly, perhaps, and improve this situation that way?
Yeah, I think that's long been thought to be. If you look at prisons as simply, here's this tough, bad place that we're putting people because they did things that we don't like, and then we're going to keep them there for 10, 20, 30 years, and then we're going to open the door and say, good luck. And, well, what's the net result of that? Are you getting a person who can contribute to society? Are you getting a person who, having no other way to really support himself, is more likely to come back in through those doors again? Again, there are other states that are doing more of this. The state of Texas, which adopted some pretty significant reforms in the past few years, they're doing more job training in prison, trying to make it easier for prisoners when they get out to reintegrate into society, as well as looking at other ways of dealing with nonviolent offenders and drug offenders. Also looking at reforms in parole that would tend to reduce incarceration. So it's part of there are many pieces to this. There's no magic bullet. There's no single answer. But there are certainly other places that are finding ways to reduce the flow coming in and those who can be safely released to find ways to navigate that, and also to try to reduce the likelihood that people are going to go into prison, go out, and then come back in again, the recidivism rate. So,
We're talking with reporter Ted Roloffs of Bridge Magazine about the proposed reforms to Michigan's correction system and what appears to be a growing sentiment to consider reforms. There's been a focus on outsourcing in recent years to cut costs. What place does outsourcing have in the future? Did that come up in your interviews?
We're talking about privatizing prisons, privatizing
yes.
services.
Yes.
Yeah, that's out there, and I don't know. In the bigger picture, I don't know. You know, I think that had a lot of traction perhaps some years ago, that this is the way to save costs. But if you think about it, comparing, if you're going to privatize a prison and maybe you're going to reduce costs that way, the biggest driver of what this budget is going to be the number of prisoners that we have. And you get into wide-scale privatization, then you can ask the question, well, what's the track record of privatized prisons? In some cases, good. In other cases, not so good. So I don't know that significant prison reform in the context of finding a way to take the share of the general fund budget down from more than one-fifth, which is where it is right now, that's going to go real far if one only looks at privatization.
You mentioned earlier, Ted, that one of your key sources here was Republican State Representative Joe Haveman of Holland, who's a supporter of many of the reforms we've stirred up here. Has he indicated to you how encouraged he is about the legislature taking up any of these reforms, or does he feel more like a voice in the wilderness, or is he more encouraged than that?
Well, he's leaving after this year. He's exiting the House, and the way he put it to me is he's pretty passionate about this, but the way he put it to me is, yeah, I hope there's someone else that wants to pick this up, because I think he well knows that it's going to take concerted effort, it's going to take some coalition building and persistence. So I think he's encouraged and he's optimistic about what he's working on, but I also think he knows that once he leaves, we're looking at a difficult road ahead to achieve significant reform.
Ted Roloffs is a reporter for Bridge Magazine. Ted has three articles in the latest edition of Bridge, all related to Michigan's corrections system. They are recommended. Ted Roloffs, thanks for joining us.
Glad to do it.
I was born under Birch Tree, and strong and deeply woven, with my tongue pressed to my cheek, I have learned from homes and howls, from my family, how to speak.
The DeCamp Sisters, our special musical guests here today on Current State. That music is coming to you live from Studio S here at 90.5 WKAR. We'll hear more from Libby and Riley DeCamp in just a little bit and talk to them as well about their two EPs and their tour coming up. I'm Mark Bayshore. An annual spring ritual is winding down in Michigan. Maple syrup season is coming to an end. Current State's Melissa Benmark went to check out one of the syruping operations in mid-Michigan. This sounds like a fun assignment, Melissa.
You know, it really was. And actually, apropos of your last guest, where I was doing this story, not actually real far from the Ionia prison complex, which is located, interestingly, in an unknown pretty part of Ionia County. As you drive west from Ionia, you'll come to the little town of Saranac. And on the streets of Saranac are these gorgeous old maple trees. They're very large. It's beautiful in the fall. And this time of year, it's not uncommon to see a lot of them with pails and spouts attached to collect sap for maple syrup. Just this week, the buckets came down. Sap went to be processed at Dusty Lane Maple Syrup outside of Saranac. And I talked to the owner, 77-year-old John Smith, about running a maple syrup business and involving the town folks in the process.
Our operation has grown over the years. We're up to somewhere around 1,200 taps now. So we have a lot of syrup to take care of, sap. As everybody knows, it takes a barrel of sap to make 1 gallon of syrup. I grew up here on this farm. Well, my first wife and I were here and for nearly 50 years. But we have a lot of fun during this time of year right out here at the shanty. And collecting a sap, boiling it down to make syrup. Been at it now ever since my grandfather started back in the mid-30s, I suppose. So we've been at it for some time. We have big groups of people come. Yesterday we had 15 or so around here working, and they just love to be out here and talking and work is fun when you're doing it the right way.
It looks like you guys are working pretty long hours out here. Is it like, tell me kind of about the season that you're in right now with the syrup making.
The syrup season is just about done. We started, we tapped the first time there on March 7th. And so we're over a month now. Generally the season runs for 5 to 6 weeks. But we're not getting any freezes now and won't be for a week or so. So we're going to be taking down the buckets and pulling spiles and wrapping things up. It's always a fun thing to get into and always fun to get out of. But we'll end up with about 250 gallons this year or so.
Is that a good year?
Not nearly as good as last year. Last year we made 361. So it's going to be somewhat less than half than last year. But we feel very fortunate to have that much. And then we had such a big year last year that we had carryover of 50 gallons. So, yeah, we have lots. So this year we'll have some dark syrup. Generally speaking, dark syrup was always thought of as a grade B and probably still is, but generally, people don't want that, but we've getting into an age now where the health club people, they like that dark maple syrup to add to their stuff, and so we didn't have any last year, hardly at all, but this year there's going to be some for whoever wants it, and but we got the better stuff too, what I call better.
What makes the difference between the dark and the light syrup?
Generally speaking, the early sap, when you first start, makes a real clear syrup. And then as the season progresses, it gets to be darker and darker. But and if it's got the taste, you don't really care. But if you get into bad syrup, it's time to be done and throw it away. So we haven't got that stage yet, but I'm suspecting within the next day or two we'll be gathering in the rest and calling it quits for this year.
One of the things I was curious about is that when you drive into Saranac from David Highway, so many of those trees are tapped. And are they all relatives? Are they friends? How is it that you have folks doing that in town?
Oh, that started about 4 years ago. The school down at Saranac has a school woods, and that's where it all started. Lots of maples in that little woodlot. So we started there, and it just grew from there. My partner, Bruce Chadwick, past superintendent at Saranac, he knows so many people in Saranac, and See, he just went around asking people if we could, if they minded if we tapped the trees in their front yard or along the street, and it just grew from there. In fact, we had a lady that see that we had tapped her neighbor, and she said, "Hey, why haven't you got mine tapped?" But there are people who don't like us tapping trees, and I respect their thoughts. Tapping trees don't hurt them at all, except the lumber people. They don't want you wrecking that first 4 foot from the ground up.
Do people feel good to be kind of a part of the tapping operation?
Oh, yes, they certainly do. Generally speaking, we've got 6 or 8 around here right now, and hard to keep them away once they get a taste of it, and they want to help. Just miraculous how it's worked.
Do any of the people in the houses in Saranac that you've asked to tap, do they get involved?
Yes. In fact, one in here now, Dean Gage, he lives on the west side of town, and he wanted to tap his. So he's got his own tapped over there and brings a sap out. Generally speaking, we'd like to have them in kind of a group so we aren't running all over. But it has worked out really good. You hook the pickup to a trailer with a tank on it, and it's so easy to go up and down the streets of town and run the sidewalks. The big thing this year, though, was the snow. Snow was 2 foot deep to walk through when we were tapping, and I'm sure that everybody else had the same problem. But we managed, and we finally got them tapped. You know, we liked syrup time. My dad always said it was the time of year when you get your muscles built up for later spring work. So others would probably concur with that. But it does get tiresome, as anybody might know. I've got so many helpers that I've kind of backed away from a lot of it this year. We've taught them how to do it.
Do you have any kind of celebration or kind of closing day for the sugaring season?
We're planning to have everybody here a little bit later, probably June or so, to get this mess all cleaned up around here and have a big feast out here. It's been a fun time, and I want to treat everybody to a good time together once again. As I said, I'm 77, and I've been in it all these years since I was little. It didn't always start here. This has been built up. The first outfit we had was back in the woods on my grandfather's, and just out in the woods with no cover over us at all. But we had fun. Made considerably less syrup than we do now. But when you get people involved, that's what they really like. We don't pay anybody, don't even pay ourselves. There's a bunch of costs that have to be met. If there is any money left over, we'd probably buy something for our feast. But it's been a fun time, and it's something that's wonderful to get into and wonderful to get out of, too. We got to get on with other things.
Well, John Smith, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been fun having you here.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Venmark.
Seeds.
the great harmonies here live on Current State, courtesy of the DeCamp sisters, Libby and Riley DeCamp from Romeo, Michigan. We'll hear more from Libby and Riley and talk to them here in just a little bit. They got two EPs and a tour coming up, so there's lots to talk about. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to Current State. Earlier this year on our program, we welcomed John Barry from the Appropriate Technology Collaborative to Studio S. He explained that the collaborative creates new technologies to improve the quality of life in developing countries around the world. The organization also collaborates with universities. And this year, a team of Michigan State engineering students worked to build a water purification system for low-income countries. Joining us now are two of the MSU students who worked on the project, Grant Golassa and Shen-Li Pei. Grant and Shen-Li, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having us on the show.
Sure. Grant, tell us how you ended up working on this project then.
Well, at the beginning of the semester, we were asked to pick which project we wanted to work on to help out the struggling citizens throughout the world. And we chose to build a device that purified water for areas such as Guatemala and other parts of Africa.
And Shen-Li, you had a number of different projects you could have chosen, and you chose this one as well?
Yeah, I chose this one as well. We just gathered a team that we all passionate on this water device project, and we all think this is where our passion is at, and it's our gut feeling to do this project.
And remind our listeners what the Appropriate Technology Collaborative is.
It's also known as ATC. They're out of Ann Arbor, Michigan. They do a lot of nonprofit work with different countries throughout the world. Right now, they're mainly focused on Guatemala. They have a couple different projects. One is solar-powered, like battery packs, cell phones, water purification devices, water heaters.
What part of the world are you looking at to really spread this technology?
So far, we spread it out in Guatemala to use, but ATC also has their website up online for everybody else to view. So over the world, people who see this device and interested in it, they can also download the file and knowing all the information be used in the regions they want it to be used. So it will be all over the world.
Okay, so this is is this a relatively low-tech device that you've created
yes,
here?
Yes, it's pretty low-tech. It only has a low-pressure mercury bulb, and then some ballast, really simple circuitries, and the battery and the switch on it.
But a mercury bulb is the heart of this thing.
Yes.
What does that do? What role does that play in purifying water?
So the low-pressure mercury bulb we purchased takes out 256 nanometer wavelength light, UVC lights, that which kills the germs and then disable the bacteria and then in the DNA side. So that's why the bacteria and the viruses, they cannot reproduce anymore.
So it's UVC light that has a particular impact on bacteria.
Right. It's also known as germicidal light.
Germicidal light.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What these are components then, Grant, that are relatively accessible for people in developing countries?
Yeah, they're we use a protein shaker for our actual container, which has three different compartments. The top compartment is where you'd store your water, where you'd scoop up your water from the river. The next compartment has your circuit board, and then the bottom compartment just has your battery pack. The batteries are all.
This is one right here. That you brought in. Okay.
I thought this was your coffee mug.
To tell you the truth, for a second, it looks just like an insulated coffee mug, like you might get. And the top is what again?
That's where your water would go, just like a normal cup.
The water is here. What's in the middle?
The circuit board.
And at the bottom?
The battery pack and the switch.
Okay, and you shake?
No, you don't.
You don't shake. No, you don't shake. Okay, but the light gets to the water, and this UV light. Has a tendency to breaks down the bacteria. What were some of the bigger challenges in creating? This is your creation then at the
yes.
ATC?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What do you know how this unfolded? What were some of the challenges associated with developing this?
So the main project was originally defined to go to a LED light bulb. But after a lot of research, we found out that LED light bulbs cost about $300 a piece if you're looking to get a UVC emitting bulb. So then we went down to the mercury bulbs because they're cheaper and more readily available. And until the LED technology moves along, it's really not realistic for people who are living on $2 a day
now
to
purchase. I've heard of mercury vapor bulbs. Is that the same?
Small pressure vapor.
It's the active ingredient in generating this light.
Correct.
You are both mechanical engineers, but mm-hmm. this project required you to understand and use various disciplines to make it work. Talk to us about that.
So this whole thing that we did a lot of research on biology side and the physics side, and also electrical engineering side part of it, because we don't really know how UVC works before, and then that's why we need to go into the website research and see what is UVC, how they breaks down the bacteria. So that's the background knowledge we need to know before we even create anything like that. And then for physics side, that we need to look into what kind of battery power we need, what kind of energy we need to kill those bacteria. And then for the electrical engineering side is the circuitries. How are we going to connect a proper circuitries for the low-pressure mercury bulbs, because they require at least 380 volts starting voltage to spike up the bulb and then maintain a lower voltage later on during when it's on.
How big an impact could this have, Grant?
It could save hundreds of thousands of lives every year. Statistically, there are, every 21 seconds a child dies in the world from drinking waterborne disease water. Mm. So,
for some people, the term engineering conjures up images of shiny new objects, the latest creation from Apple or whatever the case might be. Some people just don't think of what tools would be helpful for developing communities. How has working on this project impacted your understanding of what you can do as an engineer?
Well, most of the world isn't really solicited to by the top corporations. People in Guatemala don't have iPhones. People in Africa don't have Rolex watches. But everyone needs water. And if 1.2 billion people worldwide don't have access to clean drinking water, then this would be solicited to 1.2 billion, which would be bigger than any other market out there.
That is really exciting. Have you been to Guatemala?
No.
Okay.
No.
Do you plan to go to Guatemala?
Possibly.
Okay.
It'll be a future plan.
Possibly. That would mm-hmm. sound pretty exciting, since you're kind of talking about targeting that part of the world. What are there next steps here involved in this? Could you refine this project right here or improve this in some way?
There's many future improvements that we can done, and such as like adding a filter glass to prevent rocks hitting in the bulbs and then break the bulbs, and adding a timer on that so that the user will be able to know, okay, when I turn it on for 10 minutes, the clock start ticking, and then it rings after 10 minutes is up. So they will know when to turn it on and turn it off. So a lot of future improvements we can add it on. And also ATC is also thinking about in the future making it as a bigger scale, not just only for personal use, maybe for a community use using the UVC light bulbs to kill disinfect water. So currently, because this is only one semester, 15-week course, that we are unable to do what we all wanted to do, but we are going to carry it on to hand it off to ATC and all the other engineers they have over that organization, and then also other people who are excited about this project, and then use what we've done and
run with it.
And then go beyond.
Yeah.
Yes.
Grant Golasa and Shen-Li Pei are MSU mechanical engineering students who helped build this water purification system for residents in developing nations, all a part of the Appropriate Technology Collaborative. Grant and Shen-Li, good luck. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our musical guests here today on Current State are the DeCamp Sisters. They come from Romeo, Michigan, and altogether they've brought three stringed instruments that they're rotating amongst their app, their performances here, and you probably heard them harmonize a few minutes ago. They're very impressive, and we're going to hear from them now. This is a track called Big River from their first EP, The DeCamp Sisters, on Current State. Big River, the DeCamp Sisters, live here from Studio S on Current State on WKAR. That was just fantastic. Libby and Riley DeCamp have a few minutes to talk with us here right now. You two are from Romeo, Michigan, and for those of us who can only pick out Detroit and Ann Arbor on the map, and I'm not proud of that, where's Romeo? Wherefore art thou?
It's about an hour north of Detroit, I guess.
Okay. You two are visually striking because you both have red hair. Are you actually sisters?
No, we're not.
No. Ah, a sister act.
Yes.
Okay.
All an act. Right.
Do people mistake you for, I mean, it's part of your name, so people must assume you're sisters. Quite a few people do.
Pretty constantly. Yeah, we kind of leave it at that, and then if people bother to ask or if we have the time to explain.
You come
then,
clean.
Yeah.
We've heard some of your songs today. How do you describe your music to the stranger you sit next to on an airplane on a flight? You say, oh, you're a musician. What kind of music do you play? How do you describe this?
Well, it's something that we usually struggle with, but roots is probably the closest. And then you can throw in some folk because it's all the rage now.
Yeah. What's the most challenging part of making music like this? Is it working out your harmonies? Is it working out your guitar and banjo arrangements? What?
Well, I think for us the most challenging part is writing together. We don't really do a whole lot of sitting down and writing a song together. It's usually we'll come up with something and then bring it to the other person, and then the other person figures out a part and adds to it and whatnot. Yeah, but we haven't had much experience with, like, co-writing.
Okay. Your newest EP has a rather intriguing title, Quick, Efficient, and Deadly. Where did that come from?
That's a funny story.
Well, we're dying to hear it.
Well, oh, and deadly. I get it. Well, I squeaked, but we had a guest bass player come to record, and he came for a rehearsal, and I guess he was hungry and running out of time to get to the rehearsal, so he stopped at a Speedway and got a burger.
Who hasn't done that?
Well, we're both we're both basically vegan.
Oh, so okay.
That's
oh, yes. You haven't done that. Okay. So.
But he said, you know, they're quick, efficient, and deadly. And we thought, well, that's hilarious. And we joked about it for a while. And then we realized that our EP was pretty morbid, and it was recorded quickly and efficiently, so it seemed to fit.
Yeah, two tracks on Quick, Efficient, and Deadly, Dead in the Water and Blood on the Feathers. So that might suggest a fairly morbid view of the world here. Are you sure that trapped inside the DeCamp sisters there isn't a death metal band waiting to break out?
Oh, it'll come out someday. Yeah, if we get bored with this.
How did you two meet?
Actually, at an open mic night where nobody else was playing anything similar to the type of music that we were playing. And yeah, she walked in with long red hair and a banjo, and I was standing there with long red hair playing folk music, and I was like, hey, look at this. And then she looked at me and she thought I was a blonde, so I don't know.
Oh, no.
So this was meant to be. Tell us about the tour you're planning for this summer. Where will you be going?
Well, for the first one, it's like an eastern run. We'll be going as far out as New York and then dip down and up through Ohio.
Do you add players to your, are you going to add players to this? You mentioned a bass player or something here a minute ago. You got people who play along with you?
For the run of dates, we have our good friends from a band called Jack and the Bear joining us to play drums and bass.
Okay.
And our major date in Manhattan is at the Rockwood Music Hall, and that is on June 30th, I do believe.
Wow.
In case anyone from Lansing wants
pretty
to
exciting.
Take a road trip.
How does it feel knowing you're going to be performing in Manhattan?
Well, my dad lives there, so I'm semi-familiar with it.
Okay.
But it's still a big deal. I mean,
okay.
I mean, not that we're big deals, but
I don't know.
We
think you're a pretty big deal.
That's nice.
You've sounded great here today. This is your first time playing shows outside of Michigan, then?
We've dabbled in Ohio, but I don't know if you can really consider that out of state.
Okay.
We did a little short run through, like, up from
North Carolina
a while ago.
Well, you guys are going to play us out here in out of the program here. What are we going to hear on the way out?
This is a song called Frankenstein.
Well, while you give me just a Frankenstein,
yes.
Is this from Quick, Efficient, and Deadly as well? It sounds like it
no,
was.
No, this is for the album, which will probably be just as morbid.
Okay. Well, we want to thank the DeCamp sisters from Romeo, Michigan. There must be a website here. Let's work that in real quick.
Yes, thedecampsisters.com. We also have a Facebook page, so if you want to like us, we'll keep you informed.
TheDecampSisters.com. They're going to play us out with a tune called Frankenstein. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Well, he craves to spark a pulse and arouse a circulation. Turn his back on fellow man to be taken with his creation. What he would do to turn the gears in the mechanism of my mouth and animate my bones and flesh, so he might watch me